Welcome to episode 25 of New Tech People. Today we've got Robert Lang. Robert's a CTO who's worked from small software companies right up, grown them right up to exits, and been involved with companies as large as the NASDAQ. Robert's worked internationally in the US, Hawaii, and back in Australia. Interesting to hear Robert's take on his career, how he's got to where he is, and hopefully some learning for everyone else. Hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to New Tech People episode 25. Today we've got Robert Lang, CTO and Newcastle alumni. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks very much.
I take it there'd be a fair amount of the Newcastle tech community that wouldn't actually know who you are. I know of you. It's been a little while between drinks in Newcastle, let's call it. Give the listeners a quick overview of who you are, what you've been doing.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that. I got my PhD at Newcastle, got my bachelor's as well, but my PhD in computer engineering at University of Newcastle in 1996, and then headed overseas to work in Silicon Valley for 10 years for a number of startups, which we can talk about in much detail as you like, but also including big names like I worked at Silicon Graphics for a couple of years when they were big, and then as they sort of started to fall out of the consumer market, I worked for Nvidia for a bit, again doing computer graphics. So my PhD is in computer hardware. So I started my career as a chip designer, and when I moved back to Australia, there's less of a hardware scene here, so I moved over to managing software. And probably my most successful role in my career is with an Australian company called Smarts, that was a startup that developed software for analyzing capital markets, so trading on stock markets, and identifying bad behavior. So identifying people who are trying to manipulate the market, who are doing illegal things on the market. So we were the world leader in that space, and NASDAQ, the US stock exchange, bought us in 2010. And then I stayed on for another 5 years working for NASDAQ in the Sydney office, and continuing to run Smarts from that perspective.
Yeah, right.
So a broad range of startups and big companies, all in the technology space, all starting out as technology developer, moving into technology management, and more recently CTO roles.
Wow, that's a fair old journey.
Yeah.
If we wind it all the way back, how'd you get into technology to begin with?
I think it's a fun story. So when I was in primary school in year six, our country school in South Australia, so I grew up in South Australia, country school, and I was an academically smart kid, and I used to finish my work early, and then the teachers would have to find things for me to do. And they got shipped what was called a VIC-20, which is one of the early personal computers, and that was shipped to the school, but the teachers hadn't received any training.
Yeah.
So in one of my classes, the teacher just said, go to the staff room, unpack the box and figure out what this thing is. So I didn't know what a computer was, and the teachers didn't really know either. And so short version of the story is I convinced them to let me take it home because it was too complex for me to figure out in a couple of classes at school. So took it home and spent all my nights and weekends figuring out what it was. And then eventually, before I left primary school, ended up teaching the teachers what it was and how to use it. And just all from reading the manuals and figuring out stuff.
Oh, wow.
So I was kind of 11 years old. I was hooked. When I went to high school, similar story, but with Apple IIs, they got shipped something like 15 Apple IIs, and I asked the computer teacher, who didn't know about computers, but asked the computer teacher whether I could set up the computer room. So I spent, me and a friend spent the weekend setting up all the computers, and they let me take one home so that I could play with it as well. And that just sort of built from there, just the general interest in computers.
Yeah.
When I was preparing for university, we did a tour of one of the universities, and I saw people in those white suits behind glass doors working on circuits. And when we were told that those people were actually building computers, I just thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever heard of, because I had spent, by then 5 years or so programming computers, but I was like, how do you build a computer?
Yeah.
So I headed off to do a computer engineering degree at the Uni of Newcastle.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then out of, let's go on the university degree. How was that university degree at Newcastle? How'd you find that?
Yeah, no, I thought it was good. It had everything I need. I was lucky enough to get a scholarship from BHP in my first year that paid not only for my tuition, but also every summer I had a guaranteed job working at BHP. And I was lucky enough to be kind of ahead of the curve, because I was sat down with experienced programmers who were teaching me to program industrially before I was learning the subjects in university. So that was really helpful and a really good start, I think, you know, to a career, being able to hook into industry early.
Perfect. And mate, on that topic, because I think that's, I guess it's something that's happening a little bit more commonly now, and it's probably it sounds like a lot of people's opinion that it is the future, or is that mix of, you know, pure education or formal education and practical experience. You obviously sound like you had a positive experience doing that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, early on, I learned how important it was to be industry relevant and to be linked to industry. You know, when we jump to where did I go after my PhD, it really headed me back into industry because I felt like it was more interesting to be doing real things. Where your software or hardware or whatever you're building is actually being used somewhere. Yeah, versus, not that I'm speaking bad about research, but for me personally, research was always, let's think up a crazy idea and it may or may not have some relevance. It might be very, you know, technically smart and it might be very hard for some people to comprehend, but it also might have no practical use in the universe. So I was more torn to, wow, I'm building. You know, talking about my smarts days, when I walked into a room in a stock exchange in India and there was 30 terminals all running smart software with people actively sitting there surveilling the market, that was cool. You know, that was like, whoa, our software is really doing stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we're not just building this stuff to you know, earn a wage. There's actually real stuff happening.
No, I completely agree. I think it probably accelerated your learning as well, right? Seeing how you... what you're building and how's it actually working in the real world?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. Yeah.
Is that, if I had to ask your thoughts on the future of education then, would you think, you've obviously done your PhD as well, thoughts on future of education? Do you think it'll continue to go, you know, more of that mix between industry and pure learning, or hey, what's your thoughts on what you think would be beneficial?
It's a bit of a two-pronged thought process, I think, because I think that, you know, if you're just talking about the future of education, I think we can all see that self-learning, you know, is becoming more and more prevalent and pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, you can think of any topic, go online and, you know, there's masterclasses, there's literally a site called Masterclass, which I've subscribed to, where you have things like, you know, Gordon Ramsay teaching cooking.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like a whole course of that. And
yeah, access to information is becoming just so prevalent. And the actual best people in the world teaching this information.
The proper experts, like the real people, Steven Spielberg teaching how to be a director, you know, things like that, right? So the access to, so I think the future of learning is that sort of self-guided but still expert learning. But that said, I still personally, and that may well be my experience and my age, just see the link to industry to be just so beneficial to anyone's education. The more that you can apply it to the real world, the more that you can be applying it in an industrial, you know, or commercial application, I think that, as you said before, that accelerates your learning. It certainly seats your learning. It makes you understand, oh, I'm not just learning numbers and equations. I'm actually learning what they're for. I'm actually applying them.
Yeah. And then it says like the practical experience served you better going back into the education as well. So it was a two-pronged, I guess, benefits, right?
Yeah.
Nice. Yes. You mentioned before career-wise has taken you to the US. And, Newcastle University, career's grown into the US and then back. Mate, I'm really interested to hear that. Really interested to sort of hear people's career journeys and how that come about. You finish your degree. You were working with BHP as that went forward. What was the next move after that for you?
So, although I had a good job, you know, programming at BHP, the thing that frustrated me when I finished my undergraduate, which was equally my kind of mistake, I guess, in some sense, is that I felt like I knew a fair bit about software, but I still kind of didn't really know hardware. And then remember that story that I'd mentioned about the guys in the white suits in the room. So I'd done a lot of software. I'd learnt the theory of hardware, but I hadn't kind of applied it. And there was a professor who I knew at the university who wanted me to do a PhD. And I very realistically said to him, I don't think I want to do research as such, prefer to do industry. And just through chatting, I had mentioned to him that, you know, I was really wanted to do more hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, look, if you come and do a PhD, I'll let you design the chips that you're whatever you're researching and figure it out. So I jumped back into doing a PhD because I still had this desire to build some hardware and do some research. So my research was about parallel computing, but I had an element of it where I was allowed to at least design up the circuits and simulate them in software. I didn't get to produce them because that costs kind of hundreds of thousands of dollars. But that was the direction I took, really, was this is just me on a path to hardware still.
Yeah. Nice. And I think it probably puts you in a unique field. I think a lot of people do select hardware or software these days, right?
No, as I said, not in Australia.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a big industry in Australia. But obviously, in Silicon Valley and in the US and India and so on, we still need hardware to run our software on, so there's still a significant amount of graduates in those areas.
Yeah, nice. So then you finish your PhD?
Yep.
Through Newcastle? Yep. What was next for you after that?
So I had met a researcher during my PhD, an American researcher who was teaching at Flinders University in South Australia. We had met a couple of times because our research areas were in the same area. He was far more accomplished ahead of me. He was already a teacher, a lecturer. And so I was looking for what to do in terms of a role. And I was just looking for jobs online, and I saw that there was a teaching position at Flinders University. So I emailed him saying, I'm going to apply for this position, put in a good word for me or whatever you like. And he responded back saying, that's actually my position that they're advertising. I'm now working back in the US and I'd rather you come to the US. So he was working for a company there called Schlumberger, and he got me into the process. I interviewed at Schlumberger and ultimately got hired over into Schlumberger. But there was also that still crossroads point where, do I go academic, do I not? I had a job offer from University of Melbourne from a professor who used to be at Newcastle and had moved to Melbourne.
Yeah.
And he offered me a teaching position. And then I had the offer for the job in Silicon Valley, and I was literally, I didn't know which one.
Yeah.
And so I went to him and said, I don't know what to do. You're offering me a position, but I also have this position in the US. And he effectively said, I'll take my offer off the table if you go to the US, learn something, and then bring it back to Australia. So that was kind of his attitude towards that. So I said, that sounds like a deal.
Yeah.
So I went off to the US.
Yeah. That's great from his perspective, I'm sure. Pretty key point in your career, right?
In my career, definitely, yeah.
Because somebody was quite selfless and actually went about it from that perspective.
Yeah.
Nice. So that was the in the US.
So then I found myself in the place that anyone with a technology interest wants to be, Silicon Valley, right in the heart of it. We lived in San Jose, right there next to Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And I was designing chips for test systems that test chips. There's a bit of a meta thinking concept here because we were designing the machine that tested the production of the Pentium, which was the hot Intel chip at that time.
Yeah, right.
And so the chips I was designing were in the system that tested the Pentium. And again, got to see fully practical uses, got to go to a chip production site in Oregon, see them making the chips, see our systems testing the chips, understand how they use it, how they work. And I was working on sort of fridge-sized computers that were liquid cooled. It was very high tech, very very high end tech that hardly anyone knows about.
Yeah, right.
Members of the public don't think of these systems of producing chips. How do you make a chip?
Right. How long did you do that for?
So I was there for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then I got a job offer to Silicon Graphics to go and work on the next generation graphics machines. And part of my PhD had been focused around computer graphics and image processing, so it was kind of back more in the direction of my PhD. So that was there was yet another good opportunity because Silicon Graphics was kind of still at its height. It started to fall after that as a company in terms of a leader, but it was still the hot place to be to do computer graphics.
Wow.
And so we were working on, unfortunately, a system that never saw the light of day, but we were working on kind of the next generation graphics system that got sold to NVIDIA and became technology that's in NVIDIA's systems today. So if you have an NVIDIA graphics card, that's all sort of came from what the guys at Silicon Graphics were doing.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Mate, what was the experience like being in Silicon Valley at that point?
Technology-wise and, you know, context-wise, just amazing, the network. I mean, you really – I was there when Google was forming, you know, like it was just – it was as cliche as people say that, you know, you could meet someone in a coffee shop that was a venture capitalist who was looking to invest, you know, in companies, you know. Like it's just such a – at that time, such a networked hotspot.
Yeah.
Conversely – the lifestyle was a bit too much like that as well.
You know,
people were, I mean, we were young. I was 25, 26, right? And you would just work. You were just, you know, your friends were in the office. So you would have dinner in the office and work late. And that, as I got a bit older, that started to get a bit tiring, that, you know, we're sort of always working.
Yeah.
But that's choices, you know, because California is a beautiful place and has great beaches and outdoor wildlife and stuff. And so, you know, you can choose to go out.
Yeah.
My next gig actually took me out of California and took me to Hawaii, where I spent the next 4 years. And that was much more work-life balance, you know, much more sort of put in your hours, put in a lot of hours, but spend your weekend in the water, on the beach, that sort of thing.
Yeah, nice. Touch back on Silicon Valley for a sec. You obviously did. How many years did you do there?
I was 6 years in Silicon Valley and then another 4 working for a Silicon Valley company, but based in Hawaii.
Yeah, nice. The time there, you obviously you mentioned networking, you mentioned the ability to, you know, bump into people. Is there any key lessons that you would give other people, either moving to a technology hotbed or trying to network or build relationships with other people?
Tips is hard to say, but I mean, in general, it's just really important to work on the networks.
Yeah,
you know, think about and in a positive way and not in an artificial way. When you're meeting people, you know, what's the relationship going to be? What do they currently do? You share what you're currently doing, you know, figure out, you know, what's common between you and how is that going to work forward, you know?
Yeah.
I've been out of the Valley for 14, 15 years now, you know, not including Hawaii even, but I still have contacts that I talk to and, you know, can regularly talk to, can call up for advice and so on in the Valley. So I think, maintaining those networks, I think, is a really important part of what that provides.
So you should utilize it. Yeah, I completely agree. I think especially earlier on, building those networks to create opportunity, like even your opportunity to get to the US came through a network, right?
Yeah, exactly, 100%, yeah.
And that's just, you know, building relationships with no end goal in mind, but just building genuine relationships, and you never know, you know, where things will end up.
Yeah, I had when I was after NASDAQ had bought us, and I was working at NASDAQ, one of my top software engineers, but a very young guy, came to me and said, you know, I've got this dilemma. I've been offered a job at Amazon in Seattle, and, you know, he's in his mid-20s, and one of my best software developers, and he's like, you know, I don't want to, you know, disrespect you or hurt the team or anything like that, but I had to say to him, similar to the professor, you know, I had to say to him, it'd be hypocritical for me to say, no, stick around in Australia when you've got an opportunity to go to Seattle and work for one of the biggest, fastest growing companies. You know, you've got to have a crack at that.
Oh, I completely agree.
Yeah. So no, I definitely think it's a good opportunity.
Yeah. Nice. You mentioned you went to Hawaii. Nice lifestyle in Hawaii.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, backing up, I had worked for a startup in California, actually for the same guy who was the professor in Sydney, in Flinders. And that company had sort of run out of money, as startups quite often do. But I guess the technology part we had delivered well, and I was the head of technology. So the investor in that company, you know, again, going back to networks, so thought I was a positive member of his network. And he had another company that he had invested in that was California-based but founded by a Hawaiian, and the Hawaiian founder had, for whatever personal reasons or whatever, just said, I've got to go back to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
He happens to be a very technical, like, hands-on guy, and by his own admission, not a manager, but one of the smartest tech guys I've ever met, absolutely great hardware designer.
Yeah.
And the investor was worried, how do we have him sitting in Hawaii without a team, and if we put a team there, he doesn't want to manage a team. How do we manage a team in Hawaii when we're headquartered in California?
Mm-hmm.
And so that investor's theory was, if I was interested, I could run that team. So we'd been in California for 6 years when my wife and I had sort of said it was going to be a 2-year stint, and she was starting to ask, when are we going home? Hawaii was halfway home, so that seemed to work pretty well.
Heading in the right direction.
Yeah, so a very different environment to Silicon Valley. Even though I was flying back and forth to California regularly, so I was still connected to Silicon Valley. Hawaii's, you know, much more down to earth, much more laid back. There's not a strong technology industry there. We were one of few. And the few companies that are technology-based there are pretty much all military.
Yeah.
So a foreigner like me can't get access to any contacts there, really. It was just a change of pace, but still designing chips. So we were designing the first 10 gig Ethernet chips. So, today 10 gig is mainstream and plug it in, away you go. At that time, 1 gigahertz was amazing and expensive, you know, and we were designing the 10 gigahertz range.
Yeah, nice.
And ultimately got bought by NVIDIA again. So a different division, but we got acquired by NVIDIA.
Wow.
And then the whole team got consumed into NVIDIA.
Right. And I guess, once again, on relationships, that would have been similar issues. This team's delivered for us in the past. This team's built something we can trust in the past. Let's go down that route again.
So two experiences. One was, you know, they had a kind of a interview process as part of the acquisition where they sat down with every staff member and interviewed them.
Mm-hmm.
And the manager who was interviewing me was my former manager at SGI at Silicon Graphics.
Yeah.
So there wasn't much of an interview. He was just like, well, I know who you are, so I think interview over.
Yeah.
And then the second experience was that once they had selected us all and we had an induction process at NVIDIA, like the whole graphics team that I worked with at Silicon Graphics pretty much by then had moved to NVIDIA. So I walked into a room full of colleagues that I'd worked with before, you know, again, emphasizing just how strong the networks are, how important the networks are.
Yeah, nice. That's right. I completely agree. I think from a career perspective, startup perspective, you know, relationships and network are still undervalued. I think people recognize the importance of them, but they're still undervalued. I think people's careers can be, you know, the journey and opportunities present themselves through relationships and networks significantly easier than, you know, if you're looking for seekers as your opportunity to, you know, look for your new job or something like that.
Yeah. Literally, I mean, my whole career, every position I've worked in since completing my PhD has come from a network. So
yeah, great. Yeah. So you did Hawaii. We eventually made it back to Australia.
And NVIDIA acquired us. They kept us open for a while, but eventually they wanted to move everyone back to California, understandably. Then that was my opportunity to come home. Nice. And I started to work for another company, which not many people would know, called Agia. And at the time, it was a US company, but had an office in Sydney that was designing the first 3G chipsets. So again, we're going back in what seems like history, but it's only not that many years ago. 3G was not yet a thing or was becoming a thing, and we were developing chips that were ultimately going into Samsung phones that were doing 3G communications.
Okay. Nice.
Sounds good. Wasn't as exotic as the graphics. Computer graphics is more visual and easier to explain to your relatives. Explaining that you're doing a chip in the phone that talks to 3G is a little less exciting, but it was still high tech. It was still complex, and it was being done out of Australia.
Yeah, nice. There seems to be a lot of that built around the hardware side of things, and then you have moved into software most recently. How did you go back from that sort of that hardware? I know you had a background in both software to start with and then the hardware route and then sort of back to software. How did that, where'd the next journey go?
So somewhere in that transition, hardware design at the level that I was doing, which is what I would call is purely digital. So sort of hard to explain, you know, there's a lot of analog, there's a lot of electronics going on. But at some level, the electronics is sorted out by engineers who are better at electronics than me. And what I'm doing is just designing digital logic on top. And what happened is all of the tools and processes converged. So it actually became, a lot of the hardware developers at Silicon Graphics when I joined were software developers who were just making the switch. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to think a little bit differently because you have to think hardware, but the tools had really converged. You were writing in a language that was, you know, similar to current software languages. You were using compilers and you were using tools that were very similar. So sort of by the time I get back to Australia, you know, the actual process of developing a digital logic chip is not that different to software.
Yeah.
The production is very different, but the actual tools and processes are the same. So moving over to software as a manager, you know, as a developer, it'll take a bit of work, but it's also not that hard. But as a manager, it's really easy. As a manager, you just have to produce components and functions and organize how they get produced. You know, so it was a good benefit of the way the industry developed. I think, you know, that was able to sort of make me able to move between hardware and software at that level.
Yeah, and then you're just rolling with it. Nice.
Yeah.
What was the opportunity back in Australia? Did you move back to...
So I moved back to Agear first.
Yeah.
Spent a couple of years there. Then they shut down the Australian office there. Mm-hmm. They actually shut down the whole company, but first Australia. And I have this longtime friend who I met in university, so back to networks again. So a good friend of mine who I met in university, Andreas Fersch, and he was running this company called Smarts, and he needed a CTO, and he had constantly been harassing me to come join the company. And it was something that I didn't understand because I wasn't a fintech guy. I wasn't a financial guy. It was software, and I was still a little bit religious about I'm a hardware guy. I don't really want to do software. But, you know, he and a couple of other colleagues convinced me that actually this company is going somewhere and it's an interesting problem that needs to be solved. You know, how do you find and deal with these bad actors on financial markets? So through whatever process, he convinced me to come on as CTO and start running that. And it was actually, so Smarts itself was a company that had proven itself with exchanges, so stock exchanges.
Yeah.
But Andreas had the idea to market the same software to market participants, so like brokers and banks and so on, so that they could do their own internal compliance before the watchdog hits them with fines and so on, right? And also they can show to the watchdogs, look, we're doing everything we can to do the right thing. So the idea was repurpose the software and sell it somehow to the brokers and the market participants. So I took on the role of CTO of that spin-off company, but very quickly... Andreas and one of the founders of Smarts, Mike Aitken, you know, they realized that it didn't need to be a spin-off. These two could go together. So I was moved over to be CTO of first both entities, and then the entities merged, and then the overall entity. And then ultimately that's what we ended up selling to NASDAQ.
Wow.
From there. Yeah.
What was the experience like? So I have massive interest in around a startup scene. Obviously this growth, the end goal for a lot of startups is an exit. What was, you've been through a couple now. What was the process like selling to NASDAQ?
Lots of diligence, lots of due diligence. So my part of the process was being locked in a room with some of their smart tech people and just answering whatever they could think of. You know, so starting with drawing diagrams of the system and bringing in the key developers, the real experts who knew the code and knew the different pieces, and then whatever they wanted to ask to basically validate that what we had was real. That was kind of my key part. So while a lot of the business stuff was being worked out, finances being examined and all that sort of stuff, we were just basically describing everything we could about the technology. And as you say, I've been through a few of those, and some I've even been through some that have failed and can't talk about. But it's always that process of, you know, somebody's going to have to put their hand on their heart and say, yes, I believe this is real.
Yeah.
So they're going to interrogate you as much as they need to get to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, what we had was real. So to us, it was a couple of techies, you know, having a beer, right? Like we're just telling you how cool our technology is.
Yeah, nothing to hide, right?
No, nothing to hide. Yeah, just here it is. Here's how cool it is. Here's why it works.
Yeah.
And here's why ours is better than the rest. So, yeah.
Nice. I think that's an interesting process, and obviously, like, you've got it sounds like a pretty good experience, especially through some of those successful ones. But it is that end goal, and I guess there's not too many people get to experience that successful exit.
Yeah. So one of the things I didn't mention about my background as well, or currently, is So I was involved in a cooperative research centre. Are you familiar with CRCs at all? No, CRC. So I'll probably be really bad at explaining it, but it's a government-funded, government and industry-funded research centre. And this
like CSIRO, right?
You know, it's like it's a separate program. Yep. So cooperative research centres, CRCs,
yeah,
basically there's an opportunity at a certain time for you to pitch your idea as a CRC, which has to come with all the business planning and all that sort of thing. And if you can get industry to put money in, the government matches it dollar for dollar.
Yeah, right.
So Professor Mike Wakin, who founded Smarts, also founded the... So there's CRCs on all different topics, health, mining, Antarctica. I don't know. I can't name them all, right? So Mike Wakin founded the Capital Markets CRC, which was to fund research into financial markets.
Yeah.
We've been running for 3 years. I've been on the board of that for the past 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
Recently left when CMCRC merged with another organisation called Circa and became the Rosetta Institute. And then they formed a new board, and I'm off the board of the CRC. But I'm still on the board of what's called Capital Markets Technology. And we have a small investment fund to invest in early stage startups.
Yeah, nice.
And so we've invested in 4 or 5 companies to date over the past 3-4 years.
Yeah.
And the reason for bringing that up is, as we're talking about this diligence process, is... this is me on the other side.
You're sitting on the other side of the fence.
Exactly, yeah. So we have a filtering process, so really smart guys who do the first contact and bring the board the interesting opportunities. But then there's the opportunity for us to do that process, and I can understand the technology, and we can all understand the business model and the future and all that sort of stuff. So it's been really fun for the past 4 years to be on that side of the fence as well.
I bet. And investing in the 3 or 4 that you've invested in Australian companies?
Yes.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's exciting as well. Yeah. Exciting getting to hear some new ideas and new companies and new opportunities, I bet.
Yeah, yeah. And the other people on the board are far more experienced people than me, which is also good to just be in the room with them. People like David Skellen, who's the inventor of Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
It's pretty fun to hang out with him. It's just good to watch their processes, because this particular group of people, in my experience, they're very open to coaching. So a bad proposal comes across our desk and you're not just kicked to the curb. There's feedback. Basically you'll have someone who's very experienced at building businesses in Australia and around the world, and they'll tell you, this is what's missing. This is why we're not taking the next step with you, but this is what you need to work on next.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, and I think that's really unique about CMT, the way they work. You get that kind of good feedback. I've certainly seen pitches at startup conventions or even to I've been involved in some to VCs, where you just get told no thanks.
Yeah.
And that's it. You don't know what you did wrong. You don't know what was, whether they were just not interested. You don't get any feedback.
Yeah, that's great. It's great that, the people at that sort of senior level are prepared to take the time to put that, put that back in.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Wow. Just takes me on a completely different tangent. I think that'd be, a great world for people, especially in the tech world, that would love to be sitting on a board investing in other tech companies. How did that come about? You obviously mentioned network again, somebody you know and you had success with that same group of people. That's how that came about again?
Yeah, it's just the same network of people. Mike Aiken, Andreas Fersch, David Skinner, these guys, I'm just sort of part of their network. And so when something pops up that they think suits me, they talk to me about it.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
Perfect. Right. Same time running that, most recent role of CTO, in around that finance space again. Obviously, your successful exit in that space, worked for NASDAQ for a bit after that. Was it 5 years? And then left NASDAQ. I imagine that was sort of a part of the buyout period. You would have had to stay around for a while.
Yeah, it was nothing formal, but it was just time for me to, move on.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get back into playing around with startups again. NASDAQ is, while it's very successful and a great place to work, it's still big corporate.
Mm-hmm.
And so back to little startups. I actually spent a couple of years working for an augmented reality startup. And that's just a cool emerging technology that is really starting to appear everywhere, every corner you look around. Yeah. There's some augmented reality happening. So I spent a couple of years there, but couldn't quite crack the nut as to how do we take it beyond being a gimmick.
Yeah.
You know, the technology is cool, but I, for one, couldn't figure out
how to, business use for it, where's
how,
business case?
How to market it, how to make something big. It'll happen. Yeah. But I couldn't make it happen at that one. So then it ended up back, in fintech.
Yeah.
Again, through a network, I was contacted actually originally for a board position. But when I spoke to them, they had some serious technical challenges that they were facing over the 12 months period. And so I jumped in to help them get through what was a big transition from one platform vendor to a whole different platform vendor without slowing down their business growth, without impacting the business. So it was a big technical challenge, but it was a sort of a fixed time period, get this done kind of project.
Sounds like a big chunky role or something. You get your hands, you said you're looking to get your hands, back in the technical side.
Yeah, exactly.
Project as well. You've got an end date there. So it's something, I can get in, get this done. And you've got an end date. So, it ticks your boxes, it sounds like, for what you're looking for.
It was also quite a different experience from a personal management perspective, because I'd always worked with a direct team and most recently at NASDAQ, a big team, 140 staff, I think. But at Open Markets, all the tech is outsourced.
Mm-hmm.
So during that time, I'm not managing people, but I'm managing vendors. Mm-hmm. So a vendor in India, a vendor in Vietnam, a vendor in Brisbane, a vendor in Sydney. And so I'm managing those vendors, but I'm not having to deal with personnel, hiring and firing and HR and all that sort of stuff. So it was just an opportunity to do it, to take a different look at how to build technology as well.
That's awesome. Slight tangent. You've worked at startups, obviously very small from the ground up. You've worked in really big companies like NASDAQ. You mentioned managing in the hundreds of people. Where's, from a team management perspective, they obviously vary in size, but if you had to provide some advice or your key learnings in around how to manage teams or get the most out of teams in technology-orientated companies, any advice?
Yeah, I think that the key thing is having a clear direction and making sure everyone knows the direction and is heading in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds kind of blunt, but you have to deal with anyone who's not pushing in the right direction as quickly as possible. That doesn't mean necessarily fire them, but it means get them pushing in the right direction, because that's the only way for small teams. That's the only way to get the positive results you need, which is so critical for a startup. But for big teams, it's such a source of distraction, because it starts to hit people on different levels. Some staff members who are pushing in the same direction start to be saying, "How come he gets to swing off in the wrong direction? Like, well, who's doing it?" So it starts to affect them. So I think, what I heard recently, one presenter, an ex Amazon executive, say was, the North Star, make sure everyone knows what the North Star is and make sure we're all pushing towards that. I think that's probably the key thing. And so even when you're hiring, the hiring process not only should test people technically and test their fit for joining the team, I feel like you should test a little bit how do they respond to directions of which way are we going.
So I think aligning motivators there, right? I think that's as important as the technical skills, really.
Yeah.
Like, I think technologies can be learned, especially really good tech professionals. Hey, they have to learn new technologies, part and parcel of what they do, right? But aligning their motivators to whatever the company's doing, if there's a good match there, you can oversee, small technical learnings or gaps there.
Yeah.
I think that's actually one of the key points to recruitment or to building a team, right? Is trying to get some alignment there, making sure that everyone's got a common goal, we're all heading in the right direction. It's very easy to get sidetracked if that's not clear.
Yeah.
It's a different experience working in a startup versus a big corporate. There's different team dynamics and different, or completely different. You've got to wear multiple hats. More than likely. Do you think it's been a good experience for you going to, let's say, to NASDAQ and working in big teams there, having that sort of that startup experience? Do you think it's been a good learning experience?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, you're right. There's differences, and I personally feel I can operate in either sort of area. But there's also an extra element of what I've been doing a lot in my career, which is being the remote center. So, you know, when I moved to Hawaii, suddenly we were the team in Hawaii when everyone else was in California. And that changes communication dynamics, and that changes how you work together, which actually served me well when I came back to Australia, and now we're the Australian Design Center working for a US company, and we're just the guys in Australia. The communication dynamics change. You have to formalize, you know, a lot of what is typically informal.
I think I see a lot of people go from corporate to startup, or an experience in a startup, successful or not, and then going to corporate. I think there's a lot to be learned in a startup, just having, you know, different dynamics, potentially having to wear multiple hats, potentially having to, I guess, sometimes run a bit quicker, you know, a little bit more the opportunity because you are a bit more nimble to be able to get stuff done a bit quicker.
I mean, I see a lot of I've helped out with some friends' companies and seen a lot of big commercial companies who, as you say, they're trying to do what the startups can do. The big difference, if you had asked me 5+ years ago, is I would have always said, you know, if I'm in a big corporate, there's a bunch of bureaucracy I have to do before I start doing something. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I'm in a startup, I have a role and I'm off and running. As long as I'm in sync with the CEO, you know, and in a startup, you're chatting every day, multiple times per day. You're not avoiding each other. You're just off and running. You're not thinking of, do I have permission to do this? You're obviously thinking, do I have budget and what's this going to mean for the business and so on. But it's sort of much more direct. And what you see now over the past 5+ years is, you know, the big companies bringing in the consulting companies to say, can you create an innovation hub for me? And they're just being told, you know, autonomy, right? Like, you know, giving people the right. I mean, the whole agile development movement is really about putting in processes. When you're saying there aren't that many processes, but you're putting in processes that give autonomy to people. You know, again, they know what their North Star is, and they also know what their piece of it is, and they just get to go do it without too much bureaucracy.
Yeah, I completely agree. Completely agree. I'm running all different directions. I got down this startup route, which obviously interests me quite a bit. We're having a chat, new tech people. Obviously, Newcastle University, you're keen on, you know, seeing the Newcastle tech community grow.
Yeah.
And what's your, from an outsider's perspective, you know, having a look at what's happened in Newcastle since the time you went to university, any thoughts on what you've seen going on here?
Unfortunately, you know, I haven't seen a lot, so I probably should have done more research. I don't know a lot about what's happening now.
Yeah.
Certainly back, you know, late 90s, there must have been something going on, right, and we weren't really thinking about it, because my sort of alumni group, are all overseas, or either were or are still overseas, and a whole chunk of us are still close contacts, and everyone's doing something, you know, big around the world. So yeah. I think there was definitely a hotbed at that point, and I can only assume that it continued. I haven't really followed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so sorry, as I said, I need to get connected back into the university, and I do want to.
Yeah.
I just haven't, you know, had time.
No, I think you're right. I think there's definitely been a trend for, you know, people to graduate and had to go elsewhere for opportunity, right? A lot of those opportunities within technology were internationally. That's across Australia, even not even just Newcastle specific. But I think in Australia at the moment, it's more an opportunities, you know, in successful startups as well, or successful companies, tech companies, or just normal companies within tech teams, you know, in Australia, so people don't have to go internationally.
Yeah.
And I think on a smaller scale, again, that's happening in Newcastle. More opportunity for local people graduating to have opportunity here, which they might not have otherwise had. So I think, yeah, Newcastle's on a you know, smaller scale to what's happening in, you know, the capital cities in Australia, which is good. It's good from a growth perspective.
I think the challenge is being close to Sydney, you know, it is that, you know, you've got to figure out what the draw card is out of Sydney. And personally, I think the answer is going to be lifestyle, you know, like, you know, less crowded beaches and, yeah, less rat race, but I think what probably has to happen is for some big corp to put their money where their mouth is, to put a centre here. Okay. If you think about the US examples,
yeah,
you know, you've got Oregon, which is called the, like, the Silicon Forest, which is 1.5 hours north of Silicon Valley. They succeeded, I think, just because Intel decided this is a place to put a factory.
Yeah.
And then all the support had to build up around them. And suddenly, you know, I don't know how many employees Intel have in Oregon. It's probably more than 10,000.
Yeah.
But they just made that decision to just go out of Silicon Valley to get the space that can offer the lifestyle but can offer them reduced salaries, you know, because it's not in the big city. So we probably need to figure out some way to have someone do that in Newcastle to make that draw.
I agree. I think there's only two ways. It's either top down or bottom up. It's either, you know, having a startup here grow to a, you know, significant engineering team and really build from within, or the big company coming and setting up either, even if it's not their head office, a secondary office in Australia, you know, their major office in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane or something like that, or their secondary office here, and our, you know, engineering team of 100 plus people and building on the back of that. Because as you said, it's not only that team there, but it's, you know, the support for that as well. I think they're the two avenues.
Yeah.
They're equally difficult, but their lifestyle is the selling point, right? I think housing affordability and lifestyle, a lot of the sort of the more senior talent that we're drawing back to Newcastle is those people that are either recently married or about to have a family, looking for a backyard maybe want to, you know, have a pet so they can run around in a backyard, or they're having their second child and moving out of an apartment in Sydney or something like that and looking for that sort of lifestyle.
Yeah.
I can buy somewhere with a, you know, with a backyard and a little bit bigger place.
Yeah.
And that's definitely the selling point. And you've had a lot of success, obviously, in your career. From a day-to-day productivity standpoint, how do you run your day? How do you, you know, when you're in a CTO role managing significant amount of technology as well as people, what's the best tips you've found from a productivity standpoint?
Okay, so one of the questions you'd sent through was, what is your one productivity tool?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought if I could only have one, it'd have to be the G Suite,
yep.
Right? Because I've got Gmail, I've got Google Docs, I've got Google Sheets, I've got everything I need there. It's not very sexy in terms of one tool, but it's the tool I spend the most time in probably.
Yeah.
I try to manage my day through a fairly well-known by now principle, which is called GTD, which is getting things done, and linked to Inbox Zero.
Yeah.
So I have my Gmail configured so that I can organize my emails, get my inbox to zero, organize my emails into a GTD kind of a process. I quite often fall off the wagon and have to clean things up. But that's how I try to manage my time. So I use various tools. I use a tool called Todoist at the moment for my to-do lists. One tool that I have been experimenting with at the last couple of roles, which works quite well, is a virtual assistant, which I use one called x.ai. It's URL.
Yeah.
And you get given, so when you sign up, you pay something like $10 a month.
Yeah.
And you get assigned an AI assistant who manages your calendar and is linked into the calendar. Yeah. So you literally just copy, so you can either have Amy or Andrew, depending on your preference. So I have Amy, and if someone says to me, hey, Rob, can we catch up next week? For a bit of a chat, just need an hour of your time.
Mm-hmm.
I can reply and say, sure thing, Amy, copy Amy into the thing, and then say, Amy, can you find a time for us to meet? And what's cool about it is the AI assistant interacts with the person until is resolved. So they can propose, you know, Rob has Thursday afternoon available. That person can respond back saying, no, I'm busy, but I can do Friday. Then they can say, how about Friday, 2 p.m.? That person can say, sounds good. Then they send the calendar invites.
Perfect.
So they handle all that sort of stuff. And I was a bit skeptical, but I definitely wanted to play with it when I first heard about it.
Yeah, right.
And I've had a few hiccups, you know, like 99% of the time.
That's right.
It just gets sorted and organized. And I've even had friends joke back, you know, Amy is super efficient, and full well knowing that it's AI.
Yeah.
So that's one cool thing that I've been playing with. And it's amazing how much time that saves. Mm. And I never had, so far, I've been using it for 2 years. I've never had anyone have any negative response to it. I had people when I first proposed it actually theorize that it was kind of negative. Isn't that a bit impersonal? You're handing off to an AI assistant. Well, but when I've worked at big corporations, I've had a personal assistant.
Yeah.
and he or she would organize my calendar. So this is just an AI doing it.
Yeah.
But I was expecting some people to say it's a bit rude you hooking me off to an AI.
Yeah.
But as I said, I haven't had anyone, at least verbally, tell me, you know.
X.AI, that's really good.
Yeah.
I'm a massive believer in outsourcing the things like that. I'm building my team, right? My first hire was a PA to take some of that away from me, because it's just not a good use of time on a daily basis to be trying to, you know, book your calendar and things like that. And if you can hand that off, phenomenal, right? And something like that for $10 a month, or, you know, even if it's a little bit more expensive than that, it's really accessible for everyone, right? And if you've got two bots talking to each other, they should be able to sort that out relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And it's easy for everyone. It's now accessible. And that was the thing. I think in the past, either they weren't smart enough to be able to do that, or, you know, you'd have overlapping things, or I'm in Sydney for this one and I'm here for this one and I can't get between the two. But I've seen them work quite well to say, hey, you can't actually go back to back on that because you've got travel time and things like that. So now it's accessible and smart enough that there's no reason why nearly anyone shouldn't be able to use those, right?
Yeah. No, the first, you know, early on in using it, one of my colleagues, you know, he got the discussion, and then he emailed me on a separate thread saying, what the heck is this AI assistant? Mm. And I sent him back the link and said, look for yourself. And his first experiment was to get it talking to itself,
mm-hmm.
right? So he signed up and then responded to my request saying, well, Andrew can help find a calendar. And then, and then you don't even see the email traffic anymore. You just see the meeting invitation appear on your calendar.
Yeah, perfect.
And you can even, you know, you can change the settings, but even at the end of the week, Amy will send me a thing saying, here's what I did this week. I set up these meetings and you've got these meetings next week. And you know, and this is still pending. This person hasn't responded yet.
Yeah.
Do you want me to chase them or leave it? Or, you know, it's literally...
That's great.
It's the right entry point for AI for me.
Yeah, perfect. Can you see AI being of greater use to you in the future in other forms?
Yes. I mean, I'm a huge fan. Like, I'm definitely not the kind of person who's, you know, thinking that it's all going to be Terminator and the end of the world. I think we need to be careful and thoughtful about how we're deploying the technology. And I'd love to be actively involved in that. It's an area of interest of mine. But I can just see things like this. You know, when Google did their demonstration of the voice-based assistant booking a haircut for someone, and all sorts of people were appalled, I was like, awesome. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I think, you know, any opportunity where it can be doing something positive, you know, and taking negative things off our hands, why not?
Yeah, I agree, man. I agree. From an educational perspective, non-formal education, is there anything you do, you read, podcasts you listen to, either other blogs you visit frequently that you use to stay up to date with the latest technologies or life, education, business?
Technology-wise, I tend to sort of dig around Gizmodo and just follow the sort of top stories there. I do a lot of podcasts, listen to a lot of podcasts, but they're a bit – they're overlapping in some kind of a Venn diagram, but they're a bit out of my – direct work area, more into my hobby type stuff. So one podcast I listen to every week is called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. It's basically a podcast that looks at science and critical thinking. And so quite often that goes into technology. Quite often they'll be talking about a new technology and the implications of new technology. But they've also got a side of the skepticism side is kind of the side of addressing quack medicine and anti-vaccinations and negative things, for which if people were just taught to think critically more, that there'd be a lot less of these problems. So that's kind of a big hobby of mine. So I like studying that, reading books about that, and listening to podcasts about that.
Yeah.
Quite often getting into heated late night Friday debates on certain topics. So SGU is one, and so I listen to that sort of science-based. So I get more of my hobby is more science kind of based, while my job is more engineering kind of based.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Nice. If you had to tell your younger version of yourself a key piece of advice, anything, any one key piece of advice you'd wheel back?
I'm going to go to two again, because one we've talked about heavily. So the one is networking. So, you know, I think I figured that out early on, but there was probably a period where being told to actively work it would have helped. I think for me personally, and I don't know how much that extends to others just because of personalities, is extending your emotional tools for interacting with people, if that makes any sense. So in my younger years, and I'm still a fair bit this way, but in my younger years I was very direct, very sort of logic-based, very, you know, I'll tell it like it is, and if you don't like it, sorry. As I got older, obviously, and more mature, there comes times when, you know, you don't have to be so direct, and there's other emotional tools, there's other ways to communicate, you know, that sort of thing. So I think exploring that earlier at a younger age probably must have been a positive, might have been a positive.
It's a hard one. It's hard to formally learn that, right, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's, sometimes it is experiences and learning through mistakes.
Yeah. Especially, you know, when you come to understand your personality, you know, like I am very, still a very engineering, so very logic, and so things, there should be something that leads to a conclusion, but when you throw in emotions and, you know, anxiety and other issues or things with people, then it's not logical. I don't always work well in those kind of environments, but I've worked hard to develop that as I've gotten older.
Yeah, it's something that needs to be developed, right? It's just another skill, right? Yeah. It's a life skill. It's as hard or harder than a lot of other skills, and it's something that you need to work upon because it just doesn't come naturally, right, to nearly anyone, even the best people, the highest EQ. It's something people work upon.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, going back to skepticism, I've had mutual friends sort of realize that me and another friend very much disagree on some aspect, and I feel strongly that science is on my side.
Yeah.
And this third party will say, you seem to be friends. How can you be friends when you have this huge disagreement? And you know, I've said many times, if I only chose to associate with people who agreed with me, I don't think I'd have that many friends. You know, so I think you know you have to just figure out how to deal with those.
I agree, mate. Thank you for sharing your story today. I think it's been very interesting from my perspective, hearing about people that go on a journey, especially in around that startup scene. It excites me. I love hearing those stories, and hopefully some people got a little bit of benefit or learnings out of it. If people want to sort of find out a little bit more about you or get in touch with you, what's the easiest way?
Probably the easiest way is LinkedIn. My LinkedIn profile is, if you go to linkedin.com/AU, I think it's Rob Lang AU. Yeah, so linkedin.com/in/ Rob Lang AU, RobLangAU.
Perfect. Right. Hopefully, you know, if somebody's got some interest in, you know, the fintech world's most recent experience, but any technology and they're interested in having a chat, they'll reach out.
Sounds good.
Thank you for your time.
Look forward. Thanks. Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to this episode. You can find all the show notes at newetechpeople.com.au. We're consistently updating the website with new show notes of new episodes, so you can also catch up with all our backlog of episodes, local tech professionals. Thanks again for listening.